This program contains explicit content and subject matter which may be unsuitable for some listeners. Discretion is advised.
Smart. Sexy. Kinky. Fun.
Welcome to Sex Out Loud with your host, sex educator, author, and filmmaker, Tristan Taramino. It's sex-positive radio like you've never heard before. Tristan talks about sexuality from every angle with leading authors, experts, artists, and icons. From sex education and sexual politics to BDSM and non-monogamy, nothing is off limits. So get ready to open your mind and expand your horizons. This is Sex Out Loud. And now here's your host, Tristan Taramino.
Welcome to Sex Out Loud, everyone. Hey, it's January 12th, 2018, and we're live. So if you want to join the conversation, you can call 866-472-5788. 866-472-5788. And if you're not listening live, that's okay too. We actually have a 24-hour voicemail line. So if you have a question for me or if you have a comment about a show, you can reach us anytime at 323-SEX-8266. 323-SEX-8266. Let me tell you about tonight's guest. Whit Lopez is a Brooklyn-bred and Philadelphia-based disabled, gender nonconforming, non-binary, trans, mixed-media creator, performer, and independent curator of African-American and Boricua descent. With two visual artists for parents, creating has always been a part of Lopez's world. Their work combines the skills their parents taught them: fiber art, painting, collage, and photography. The work also contains elements of their formal training in theater and classical music, including costuming, staging, and props. Their visual work and performance art uses their background in anthropology and Africana studies as a lens to examine, decolonize, and reconstruct aspects of their own identity. Welcome to Sex Out Loud, Whit Lopez.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being on. We don't get to talk about art that much on the show, and art is like one of my favorite subjects of all time. So I'm really excited that you're here.
Well, thank you.
There's so much I want to ask you. So it's hard to know sort of where to begin, but I guess I want to begin by asking, when did you come to identify yourself as gender nonconforming / non-binary / trans, and how do you navigate the world with those identities?
So I can't pinpoint the exact moment when I identified that way. I remember when I was like 4 years old and we were in the car with one of my mom's friends, and she was like, "So what do you think you are, boy or girl?" And I was like, "Oh, I'm like both at the same time." And everybody in the car laughed, and they were like, "That's not possible. You can't be that thing." And later when I was in high school, we were filling out like the Scantron forms for the exams, and I would always leave the sex part empty, the male or female part. And my teachers would just fill it in for me. And one time I went to lunch and I told my friends, "Do you ever have a hard time picking the M or the F?" And they laughed at me too. And I was like, "Oh, okay, so I'm alone in this." And it wasn't until about 2005 or 2006 that I was watching like the Sundance Channel. And there was like a documentary by some folks who were calling themselves genderqueer. And the way they were describing themselves and their feelings about their bodies and their feelings about gender and sexuality and sex, that I was like, "Oh my God, that's it. That's the thing. That's how I feel." And even though like originally I was calling myself genderqueer too, because I had seen that film, I preferred the term gender nonconforming and also non-binary. So that's kind of how I came into it.
And it's so interesting because it was media representation that like gave you this aha moment, and you of course are creating representations for other people to maybe have their aha moments.
Oh, definitely, definitely.
So one of the first things people might notice about you is that you sometimes have facial hair. You don't shave your underarms, but you also wear lipstick. Let's talk about hair and hairiness and what it means to you, what it signifies. Let's talk about hair.
Definitely. So for me, like, hair feels like a very, very powerful thing because it can completely change everything. It can change how people view you. It can change how people treat you. It can change how you feel about yourself. And I mean, I've always kind of been hairy. The first time I remember shaving was like third grade because a kid was like, "You have a mustache." And I was like, "No, I don't." And I got really self-conscious about it, you know, as a third grader. And I went home and took my father's razor in the bathroom and tried to shave my mustache off. And so it's been like, it was a battle for me for a long time, like trying to figure out what to do with the facial and body hair that I had. And one day I just got tired. I was like, why am I doing this for everybody else? Like, everybody else is happy with the way I look except for me. Because I know when I go home, I know the regimen that I have to do to keep this hair off of my body and off of my face. And this is maybe like 2010 that I really like said that to myself and was just like, that's it. I quit. I'm not doing this anymore. And I decided to not make shaving a priority. And for me, that was probably one of the most liberating things I could do for myself, to look at myself in the mirror with a mustache and a goatee, with chest hair and, you know, armpit hair, and say to myself, this person in the mirror is just as beautiful as the person I am when I don't shave. And it was difficult, you know, like I'm non-binary, but I'm female assigned at birth. And so the expectations of female assigned people to take care of that hair, and I say take care in quotes, you know, because it's something that we have to do because it's a problem. In the pressure from society to do those things, they weigh very heavily on you. And if you don't do it, other people will remind you of those social pressures, and they will make comments that will weigh heavily on you. So it hasn't been like an easy journey for me to get to this point where I just say, you know, I accept the way I look and I'm fine with it. And I feel desirable in the way that I look. But I'm glad that I made it to this point.
You know, I've looked at a bunch of your work, and desire and desirability seems to be a recurring theme. And I wondered what you have to say and what you want to say about desire in your work.
So for me, there are a lot of identities that within the larger social constructs that I hold that people don't find desirable. So my hair is one, my size, complexion, facial features, the fact that I am disabled, that I'm mentally ill, and a few other things that are not considered desirable by larger society. And so in a way to love myself, I had to destroy those notions for myself. And so the things that it's like, oh, people won't like you if you do this, or people won't like you if you look like that, or you can't do this and that and expect people to be nice to you, which are things that people have actually said to me. Like somebody said to me one day, they were like, oh, you can't be hairy and disgruntled because nobody's going to like you. And it's like, oh, but I can be. I can still be hairy. I can still be upset about things, and I can still decide that I'm going to be desirable. I can still find myself and people like me desirable. And I can still find love, and I can still find romantic interest, and I can still express my sexuality and still look the way I do and be the way that I am. And I think it's important for a lot of folks who fall outside of the, you know, what society expects for desirability, to find themselves desirable and to find those little things about themselves that other people are like, oh, that's disgusting, or oh, I would never think that was beautiful, to find it beautiful in yourself. And that's important for me, which is why, like, I kind of put desirability into most of the work that I do.
And how do you reckon with it, like, on a regular basis? I feel like this is an issue for so many people, because truthfully, all of us are, like, not fitting, you know, the criteria of what is desirable by society standards, because society standards are, like, way, way unattainable and ridiculous. And also, they've just been sort of set in stone as this is what is sexy, or this is what is pretty, or this is what is hot, right? Like, on a regular basis, I feel like people are constantly looking. Like, how do you walk through the world and see all these images that don't look like you, and maintain your center, maintain your sense of self, while, like, sort of bombarded by media that says everything you're doing is wrong?
That is a really great question.
Thanks.
It's not easy. That's, like, number one. It's definitely not easy to do it. And it is, like, a constant reassurance and a constant negotiation of what I want to do when I get out into the world, or what I am projecting when I get out there. So, I mean, there are a lot of days where I don't feel like dealing with stares. I don't feel like dealing with slurs. I don't feel like dealing with things that people are going to say. And so, you know, I might wear a hoodie to wherever I'm going, or wear a scarf wherever I'm going, so that I don't have to hear what people say. And that's what I do on the days where I'm not feeling great, and on the days where my self-esteem is feeling weak, and or where I just know that I can't mentally handle it, I can't handle the pressure of it, that's what I do. Because, yeah, it's not easy. And like you said, like, none of us really fit, and those things are difficult to attain. And so on the days when I can't even convince myself, I definitely have, like, safety nets in place to make myself feel safer.
Yeah, because I'm just always curious, like, how we can incorporate, like, strategies and tools to, like, block out, you know, to block out the negative self-talk and the images around us. Like, how do, you know what I mean? Like, what do you say to yourself
Absolutely.
In the mirror before you leave the house? Like, it's, like, a really practical thing, I think, for some people, right? As we
Definitely.
Sort of shore ourselves up. Okay, we got to take our first commercial break. I don't know how that happened, but it did. Let's take a break, hear from my fantastic sponsor, The Pleasure Chest, who makes this show possible. And when we return, we will talk more with Whit Lopez. So stay with us. Hey everyone, I love toys that leave an impression. Whether it's your first encounter with the magic wand or the luxurious feel of a leather paddle, everyone has that special toy that's both an implement of pleasure and an aphrodisiac. Haven't met the right toy yet? Well, the Pleasure Chest invites you to fall in lust. With boutiques in New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago, the Pleasure Chest staff is committed to helping you find the right toy in a safe and non-judgmental environment. Visit pleasurechest.com and browse their educators picks section for some of my favorites, or visit their special collections page and get inspired. Use the coupon code Tristan at checkout and enjoy a free massage candle with your purchase, courtesy of the Pleasure Chest. B-Vibe is a premium collection of anal sex toys. Their products feature different sizes to accommodate users of all shapes, sizes, and experience levels. B-Vibe's high-end designs are couples-friendly, body-safe, and offer innovation aimed to create an exceptional user experience. You know I've got really high standards when it comes to anal toys, and I am in love with these. Plus, they stand behind each item with an easy-to-understand, hassle-free warranty. Dubbed as the Apple of anal,
Learn how B-Vibe and its premium anal plugs are engaging couples to discover the amazing pleasures of anal play. Visit bvibe.com and use coupon code Tristan to receive 20% off your purchase.
Streaming live, the leader in internet talk radio, voiceamerica.com.
You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to Tristan at puckerup.com. That's Tristan at puckerup.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. Hey, do you know that my sex educator bootcamp level 1 and level 2 are now available online? That's right. If you or someone you know is a budding sex educator or is a current sex educator or has been working as a sex educator for 5 years, no matter which one of those may describe you, my bootcamp will give you all the tools you need to think about your career in sex education and also get serious about streamlining your business, learning about how to market yourself, all the skills that sort of no one teaches the independent sex educator. So if you're interested, the website is sexeducatorbootcamp.com. And I've got a special sale for all my listeners. You can save up to 30% off the regular price by going to sexeducatorbootcamp.com/details-discount-enrollment. I made that difficult for you. You may have to press pause and rewind. Sorry, that's such a long URL. sexeducatorbootcamp.com/details-discount-enrollment to get a discount. I'm talking today with Whit Lopez, and picking up on what we were talking about before the break, Whit, you are someone who is unapologetically fat, disabled, Black, and Latinx. And at this moment in time under this government, I think that people, if you were just one of those things, I think folks would think of you as devalued or even disposable.
Yeah.
But this makes me think of Sonia Sanchez, who was a member of the Black Arts Movement of the late 60s and 70s, has this great quote where she says, "The Black artist is dangerous. Black art controls the, quote, Negro's reality. It negates negative influences and it creates positive images." So I wanted to know if you consider yourself dangerous.
What kind of dangerous are we talking? No, I'm just kidding.
It's totally open to your interpretation.
I think it's dangerous to socially constructed norms, honestly, because the way I view myself shatters those things. Because I'm not, like you said, I'm not thin, I'm not whatever else, I'm not able-bodied. And so those things are dangerous to how people construct what certain things should be like in society. And so, I mean, in that case, I would say, yes, dangerous.
You also, I read an interview that you did in Philly Magazine where you said, "Embracing absurdity allows me to use levity in my work as a method of healing and resistance." So I want to hear more about this, the idea that that the expectation often on artists of color is to sort of make art about trauma or about oppression. And you have like a sense of humor and like to infuse your work with that humor. And you see that as actually as a tool and strategy.
Absolutely. I think, like you said, for a lot of artists of color and a lot of artists from marginal backgrounds, the art world can sometimes be a very painful place. So for me, you know, a lot of themes that I've noticed that can be painful are, you know, immigration stories or histories regarding like slavery or colonialism, things of that nature, that when you're a person of African descent or a person of indigenous descent, these things are extremely, extremely violent, and they're violent histories that, you know, the stories have been passed down or that live on in textbooks or, you know, that you've seen in movies and that are embodied. And so you live them on a regular basis and you don't necessarily want to make your art about them, because then when you look at that thing that you made, you're reliving the thing again. You're reliving that traumatic experience again. When somebody else looks at it who comes from a similar background as you, they're also reliving their similar story that, you know, is almost like the story in your art. Or if another artist comes in and sees the work, it also triggers the trauma that they have, that they're carrying with them. And so I like to create art that doesn't have to trigger people's trauma like that, and that doesn't have to trigger my own trauma, so that if I go to an exhibition where my stuff is, I don't have to see it again. I don't have to see it up on the wall. And I don't have to relive it in front of everybody that's there. And I don't have to take it home with me and put it up on my wall and continue to relive it. So I do like to bring levity into things and absurdity into things so that I can express the humor that I find in the world, but also to, so that other people can experience that humor as well, and so that they can have a laugh or so that they can have fun within an exhibition that they wouldn't necessarily have in other exhibitions, and they don't have to go home carrying the burden of that pain and that trauma and reopening wounds for themselves or for other people who they might share that experience with later.
And I think this makes a lot of sense to people and in terms of visual art. And so I'm interested to know, because you work in multiple mediums, about specifically about fiber arts, like why that medium? Like what does it allow you to do, and how do you think of it? I want you to sort of define it for people. I don't want to assume that everyone even knows what that is. I want you to define it, and also, yeah, and so let's define it, and also why is that one of your chosen mediums?
Sure. So fiber art is different things for different people. So some people work with paper, some people work with leather, some people work with yarn. I, in particular, I crochet, I knit, I sew. I also do embroidery, cross stitch, things like that. And I upcycle a lot of like old clothing into new things, or I just put a lot of different things together. So I chose it as a medium, more so because it's something that is practiced in my family. Like my mother's a seamstress. She's the one who taught me how to crochet and knit. And my father, he taught me how to embroider, which is something that he learned from his from his grandmother, who was my great grandmother. But my father's mother was also a seamstress. So these things were things that I grew up with that were constantly around me. So it wasn't necessarily something that I like picked out of thin air. It was something I was taught to do as a child that I carry with me. But the reason I chose it, kind of as the art, part of the visual art that I base my practice in, is because I love seeing the way people engage with texture. And texture can be very soothing for a lot of people. So when things are very soft, a lot of people like it. You know, a lot of people want to engage with something. They want to touch something that is not abrasive, that is not jarring to them. People like bright colors. And it's easy for me to pick things that are brightly colored within fibers, different yarns, different fabrics, different patterns on them that people really like to look at. And so also part of my practice is that people can touch my artwork. They can rearrange my artwork. They can throw it on the floor if they want to. They can throw it at somebody else in the exhibition if they, somebody else is visiting the exhibition if they want to. And so it allows people to engage with it in a different way than most artwork, because you can't throw a painting around like that because it'll be damaged. You can't throw around ceramics because it'll break. But with the fiber arts and with things like pillow-like structures, they fall on the floor and they don't break, and they can be washed. So they can be used over and over again by all types of folks, and they won't be damaged, and folks will enjoy the texture experience too.
And do you consider it like a queer art form?
That's a really good question. I know a lot of queer and trans people who do engage in fiber art, but I don't know if I necessarily consider it a queer art form.
I just wondered because I feel like there's not, it's not the first thing that people think of when they think of, quote, art. And yet there's
a rich
history to it. And the way that you describe it also feels, it almost feels like a more intimate way for people to, like the fact that there's this element of touch and people can interact with your art in a different way than sort of standing back and viewing a painting or looking at a photograph. There's this like intimacy to the fiber arts, I think. And so I'm wondering if you associate that with queerness.
Honestly, when I think of fiber arts, I think of femininity and just kind of like, I don't want to say cliche, but kind of this like divine femininity, because for a lot of cultures, fiber arts were passed down through women and through femmes, and female identifying people or female presenting people were the ones who carried the fiber arts within them. They were the ones who were making clothing. They were the ones who were making home goods, you know, or making baskets or all types of things that we do with different fibers. And so it's often connected with like this feminine energy, which I think is a great thing. And I mean, a lot of folks, like there's a lot of people who are like, oh, you know, it's women's work. But I think that that's a really terrible thing to say about it, because it's really powerful and it's kept so many people alive for so many generations. There's a lot of power in fiber arts and in associating it with women.
Okay, we've got to take another commercial break. When we come back, I want to thank Raymond, who's live tweeting as usual. And we're going to talk about a specific photo shoot, and Raymond's going to send the link out now on our Twitter feed. So folks, if you want to go look at these photos, we're going to talk about that in the next segment. Photos that Wit collaborated with Eva, is her last name Woe?
Yeah.
Is that how I pronounce it? Eva Woe. So we're going to tweet out that link so you can take a look at the photos, and we're going to talk about them after the break. Hey everyone, I love toys that leave an impression. Whether it's your first encounter with the magic wand or the luxurious feel of a leather paddle, everyone has that special toy that's both an implement of pleasure and an aphrodisiac. Haven't met the right toy yet? Well, the Pleasure Chest invites you to fall in lust. With boutiques in New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago, the Pleasure Chest staff is committed to helping you find the right toy in a safe and non-judgmental environment. Visit pleasurechest.com and browse their educators picks section for some of my favorites, or visit their special collections page and get inspired. Use the coupon code Tristan at checkout and enjoy a free massage candle with your purchase, courtesy of the Pleasure Chest.
B-Vibe is a premium collection of anal sex toys. Their products feature different sizes to accommodate users of all shapes, sizes, and experience levels. B-Vibe's high-end designs are couples-friendly, body-safe, and offer innovation aimed to create an exceptional user experience. You know I've got really high standards when it comes to anal toys, and I am in love with these. Plus, they stand behind each item with an easy-to-understand, hassle-free warranty. Dubbed as the Apple of anal, learn how B-Vibe and its premium anal plugs are engaging couples to discover the amazing pleasures of anal play. Visit bvibe.com and use coupon code Tristan to receive 20% off your purchase.
The Internet's number one talk station. Number one talk station. VoiceAmerica.com.
You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to Tristan@puckerup.com. That's Tristan@puckerup.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. I want to give a shout out to my amazing sponsor, The Pleasure Chest. The Pleasure Chest has this fantastic programming at their stores, their Pleasure Ed, Sex Ed classes. All the classes are from 8 to 10 p.m. and they're all free. And I want to tell you what's coming up. In L.A., January 17th, Blowjobs and Beyond with Chris. In New York City, January 17th, DIY Porn, from Naked Selfies to Naughty Sex Tapes with Tina Horn, who's been a guest on the show before. That should be funny. They also have, this isn't a free event, but it is a ticketed event, but January 20th in New York City, Party of Two comedy show with Vanessa Valerio and Anita Flores. And in Chicago, January 24th, Ultimate O, Multiple Orgasms with Antoinette Elizabeth. Also, you should go to thepleasurechest.com and check out, they've got a whole section of curated gift sets for Valentine's Day. So if you're thinking about getting your sweetie something sexy and you're like, I don't know what to get, check out these gift sets, which are pretty cool. So go to thepleasurechest.com to find out about those events and to find, you know, something special for yourself. So I'm talking today with artist Whit Lopez, and Whit, in many of your collaborations, you have used your own body and your image as the subject, as central to the image creation. And I'm wondering if that feels scary to you ever.
It is. it can be very scary. A recent collaboration that I did with Eva was published, and the aftermath of it on social media was a very scary place to be. The things that complete strangers from all over the world had to say, some of them were extremely encouraging, like really, really nice stuff, and some of them were the ugliest things I've ever seen people say. Putting my body in a place like that can definitely be scary, especially when people are responding to it from behind a keyboard.
Right. So we're talking about this photo series you did with Eva Wo, and it explored burlesque. It was like really sort of fantastical and performative, really bright colors, really sexy. And it was published on Afropunk.com. And, you know, I have the general rule always, never read the comments. But I did. because the comments are just...
Yeah, that's my rule, too.
And it's, like, not even just for my own stuff. But it's, like, I don't even want to read the comments on other stuff. Because people... It's where the darkness is. That's what I'm just going to say, okay?
It really is.
I mean, and so yeah. And also, this is, like... This is a site that centers around people of color, right? So I'm thinking it's not going to be like publishing it somewhere else. Like for some reason I thought, okay, well, this is going to be a sort of more of a crowd that's going to be supportive, like from the get-go. And so I was shocked by the comments. I was shocked by the shit that people were saying. And I've read that you said you felt empowered by the process and empowered by the resulting images. But then do you in fact then feel disempowered by this kind of feedback?
I don't. I don't feel disempowered by the feedback. It's something that I expect, and it's something that I've also experienced in person with people. Like I said, it's something that I expect. So I knew that it would happen. I just didn't want to accidentally see it like I did. And I didn't see it on Afropunk's website or on Facebook when they posted it, but they posted it on Instagram. And people who knew me started tagging me in the comments. And that was how I accidentally saw what other people said, because then people who were saying rude things were like trying to tag me or were responding to what my friends said.
Wow.
So, yeah, I didn't feel disempowered though. It kind of just made me want to do it more, kind of as a middle fingers up, you know, sort of experience.
Right. Well, the one thing that it definitely sort of illustrated was that no one seemed ambivalent about these images. You know what I mean? It wasn't like everyone was just sort of like, oh, ho hum. They really seemed to sort of touch a nerve because it takes a moment out of someone's day to like stop and write something. And so it felt, so on that part, it felt like, okay, this is touching people in all these different ways. It's confronting in some ways, I think. It makes you confront your own sort of ideas and maybe biases around your expectations of what people, you know, should look like or what is sexy. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I love using my body as a way to hit people's nerves. I love that because it makes them question themselves and why they think something is sexy or why they think part of me can be sexy but not another part of me. I love that.
But I think it's also puts you in a really vulnerable spot because it's one thing to sort of take a picture of something and put it out there and people be like, this art is crap or this art is interesting or this art made me think. But it's another thing to put your own body on the line and open yourself up to that kind of critique.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think people are going to find a way to critique you, you know, critique your body no matter who you are and no matter what you look like. So it's just kind of another level to that. They're going to do it anyway. So might as well do what I want while they're doing what they want.
So for me, I feel like your work is part of a larger community of artists. And it makes me think of just like, these are just like names that, off the top of my head that I thought of. Faviana Rodriguez, Ignacio Rivera, Nio Bustamante, Faith Ringgold, Molly Crabapple, Leah Lakshmi Piepsna Samra Sinha, who's been on the show. All of these folks consider themselves activist artists. And so I'm wondering if that's part of your identity as well, if you consider yourself an activist artist.
I do consider myself an activist, and I do try to center my art on activism. And I think that healing, but also like performance in the way that I allow myself to do it and am able to do it can be revolutionary and can be activist work in the way that they are.
So what would you say then as sort of an activist artist at this moment in history, do you feel spurred by all the absolute and utter horror going on in our country right now? Or do you feel sort of paralyzed by it?
It's mobilizing for me, the way things are going in the country. And one of the ways that I've been using the things that I have and the things I have access to as a way to, you know, be an activist and create change in my community, in my immediate community, is through using my art studio, my current art studio, as a safe space for people, predominantly other queer and trans artists, especially like queer and trans artists of color who live in the area. I allow people to come by for skill sharing and for co-working, or just to eat food, you know, in a safe space where they're the only ones that are existing in the space. I play music, like music of their choice is played, the food of their choice is there. And once I started doing that, people started donating like tokens, bus tokens, subway tokens, or like Uber rides, so just so that people could get to the space so that they could have a space to feel safe. And so that's kind of how I marry my art practice with activism in a revolutionary sort of way that allows me to mobilize myself as a disabled person who can't always, like, I can't go to marches the way I would like to. I can't, you know, I can't go to protests the way I would like to. But this is a way that I can create a safe space for those same people and for myself to exist and to be able to fight another day.
And so this all sort of happened organically.
Yep, it definitely did. I was an artist in residence, and so I was given an art studio for free for a year. And then something happened socially, and I just saw the, like, devastation of my friends and my family and my community. And I was like, well, you know, y'all are welcome to come by for snacks. Y'all are welcome to come by, decompress, to talk about your feelings, color in some coloring books, play with some Play-Doh, you know, sleep on the couch if you want. And from there, it just blossomed into a space where people can come whenever they need to do that exact thing, to decompress, to de-stress, to recharge, to network with other people. And yeah, it definitely happened organically.
But it's interesting because I think there just aren't enough of these kind of spaces in general, right? Like spaces where people on the margins feel safe. And I feel like it feels even more acute now because I feel like there's this sort of permission being given for people to be openly racist, openly hostile to folks. So it feels like the world doesn't feel that safe for people on the margins.
I mean, honestly, the world, the way it's created, has never really been a safe place for people on the margins. But it's not getting better now. It's definitely not getting better now. And so I do think that these safe spaces need to be more prevalent and there need to be more for folks. And they also need to be more accessible. And that's one of the things that I actually regret about my current art studio, is that the only way to get in is with steps, which is a problem for me on some days because some days I can't walk or stand. So it's like, well, how am I going to get into my own art studio if I can't do these things? But it's also great for folks who can't afford to go other places. Like, you know, you might not be able to afford to sit in a cafe and get the coffee, but the studio, you know, I have free tea, free coffee, hot chocolate for folks. So accessibility to safe spaces is a huge issue, especially with the current climate of the country and the world.
And how much longer do you have that space?
Oh, don't make me think about it. I'm just kidding.
Oh.
I have it until August.
Okay. So no, that's
that
okay.
Long.
You've got some time. Okay, let's take another break and hear some commercials. And when we come back, more with Whit Lopez. So don't go anywhere.
Hey, everyone. I love toys that leave an impression. Whether it's your first encounter with the magic wand or the luxurious feel of a leather paddle, everyone has that special toy that's both an implement of pleasure and an aphrodisiac. Haven't met the right toy yet? Well, the Pleasure Chest invites you to fall in lust. With boutiques in New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago, the Pleasure Chest staff is committed to helping you find the right toy in a safe and non-judgmental environment. Visit pleasurechest.com and browse their educators picks section for some of my favorites, or visit their special collections page and get inspired. Use the coupon code Tristan at checkout and enjoy a free massage candle with your purchase, courtesy of the Pleasure Chest.
B-Vibe is a premium collection of anal sex toys. Their products feature different sizes to accommodate users of all shapes, sizes, and experience levels. B-Vibe's high-end designs are couples-friendly, body-safe, and offer innovation aimed to create an exceptional user experience. You know I've got really high standards when it comes to anal toys, and I am in love with these.
Plus, they stand behind each item with an easy-to-understand, hassle-free warranty. Dubbed as the Apple of anal, learn how B-Vibe and its premium anal plugs are engaging couples to discover the amazing pleasures of anal play. Visit bvibe.com and use coupon code Tristan to receive 20% off your purchase.
Stimulating talk.
It gets those synapses in the brain firing really fast.
All the time.
The number one internet talk station where your opinion counts. VoiceAmerica.com.
You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to Tristan at puckerup.com. That's Tristan at puckerup.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. I've been talking with artist Whit Lopez. And Whit, I want to ask you about some of your upcoming things, where people can see your work. So you have an upcoming exhibition and a queer porn film festival in March?
Absolutely. Exhibition... is going to be at William Way LGBT Community Center in Philadelphia. And it's opening March 9th. It'll be up until April 27th. The opening reception will be March 9th. And the film festival will be also in Philadelphia at Vox Populi March 23rd and 24th. The month of March, it's going to be really interesting.
And so what are you... What do you have in the Queer Porn Film Festival?
Well, I'm going to have some photography. I'm going to be modeling for some photography that's going to be up at the film festival because it's also going to be an exhibition space.
Ah, okay. All right, because I was like, do you also make queer porn? I didn't see that.
Yep, surprise. No.
And also, they make queer porn. Wait, what? Okay.
No.
Okay, so there isn't a secret pornographer part of this that we're going to reveal. No. Okay.
Sorry.
That's okay. No, it's totally fine. I just want to make sure that I'm like covering all the bases here. I don't want to discount your discussion of accessibility that we had in the last segment. And I'm wondering how we make queer and art spaces more accessible. I think people like who are not oriented around disabilities think, oh, like you mean wheelchair accessible. But I wonder if you'll talk a little bit about what it means to make a space truly accessible, because it's much more than that.
Absolutely. It is much more than that. So accessibility for me personally with my body means that a space does need to be wheelchair accessible, even though I don't use a wheelchair. I usually, if I'm having issues with my legs or my balance, I use crutches. But also I have very extreme food allergies, which can kill me. So food also needs to be accessible when I go places, which I think a lot of people often forget about. They forget that people, you know, they're like, oh, we'll just have wine and cheese or whatever. And if somebody has an extreme dairy allergy, that cheese can kill them. So I think about those things too when I think about art spaces. Also scents and people who have chemical allergies or chemical sensitivities. Something as simple as, you know, a splash of perfume on your wrist can give that person a sinus or upper respiratory infection for like the next 2 weeks. And so I like to consider those things too when I pick a space where my art's going to be. And also I don't use scented things in my art studio so that people can have access to it when they if they have that condition. Another thing is at my last solo show, in addition to the labels that I had, I also had Braille labels printed and large print labels printed that were by request. So if people needed large print, it was there for them. And if people needed Braille, it was also there for them in a booklet form. because I think it's super important to include people in artwork who have vision problems as well, which I also do have a vision problem. So it is something that comes to me when I'm thinking about my own art. But there's a lot of other things that are important for people to have that I wish I saw more in the art world, including ASL interpreters or sign language interpreters would be a great addition to things. Also, people captioning videos that they make is another great way to be inclusive of folks with disabilities. And there's a whole host of other things that I'm probably forgetting right now, but that are absolutely necessary to making spaces more accessible. Also, chairs. Chairs are super important. A lot of times people like to stand around galleries and talk, but some of us can't stand for extended periods of time, and that needs to be considered. So chairs are a great way to make spaces more accessible for people too.
No, you've covered a lot. You've covered a lot. And I think that if we want to make art kind of for everyone, we have to think about how everyone can like see it or hear it or feel it, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Now, you also talk a little bit about death. Like, you also have this little streak in your work that is a little macabre. And I wonder if you would speak about that.
Sure. So I'm chronically ill, and I've had a lot of instances where I've been like very close to the brink of death, where it's like, oh, I ate this thing and now everything in my body is swelling and I can't breathe. Oh, I guess I'll go die now. And so just my own experiences with being so close to death on so many occasions is that I've come to embrace it because it's definitely part of my lived experience. And it's part of the lived experience of a lot of people with disabilities and chronic illnesses. And so I think it's important to incorporate that into artwork. But I like to incorporate it with a little bit of humor as well, too, because to me, sometimes it is funny to come that close and to not be completely engulfed by it. And it's also important for me to share my experiences with coming so close to death, or things that kind of point towards death in my work or in my life, and to reference them through my work, but without being too dark about it.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's like, how do you balance this stuff that you were talking about at the beginning of the show about how you don't want to sort of trigger people or relive trauma or go deep into sort of traumatic places, but you have this reality of how you walk in the world, right? Which
Absolutely.
You're saying like death is like a component of that, is present. And how
Absolutely.
Do you kind of balance how do you balance the kind of darkness and lightness of it?
Well, I think part of the darkness that we feel around death and the fear that we have is like how we're socialized to think about it and how we're conditioned to think about it. And so part of my process of involving comments on death or comments about dying within my work allows me to decondition myself from my feelings about fear of death and fear of dying, because it is inevitable. And so I apologize if it triggers other people. And I hope that it doesn't, which is also why I try to add some humor into the context of it when I talk about it from my own perspective.
Well, like these things that we were talking about today, it's another taboo, right? It's another
Absolutely.
Taboo that we don't necessarily kind of lean into, that not a lot of people are talking about.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
I want to thank you so much for spending this hour with me and for being on the show. This was just such a really great conversation. I want to remind people, Whit Lopez is a Brooklyn-bred and Philadelphia-based disabled, gender nonconforming, non-binary, trans, mixed media creator, performer, and independent curator. The best place to find them these days is on Instagram at WhitNotWhit. which is WITNOTWHIT, Wit Not Wit. I want to thank everyone who makes the show possible, executive producer Karen Dana, associate producer Raymond Johnson. He's been putting out some really good links to pertinent articles that, you know, that are really good to read if you're interested in talking more about these subjects. Announcer Cooper Beckett from Life on the Swing Set, Matt, my engineer, everyone at Voice America. Tune in next Friday, 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern, for another edition of the show. Until then, you can find me on Facebook.com/AskTristan. I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Tristan Terramino. The show is on Twitter at Sex Out Loud Radio. And in the meantime, till we talk again, take some time to talk about sex out loud.
That's a wrap on today's show. Go to voiceamerica.com to listen to this and other episodes on demand or as podcasts. And make sure you come back next Friday night at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 Pacific, for Sex Out Loud with Tristan Terramino on Voice America Variety.